for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
My friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, and on the web at whiterosesociety.org, radiopower.org, and live365's live365.com's American FM. There you go. And also on cable systems in 29 states. On CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. I saw I got an email here from a person who notes that they saw a customized Washington State license plate last night. This is so great. And I'm almost reluctant to say this on the air because the license plate police will get out and track this poor person down. But it's just great. And, you know, if you're going to get your car renewed, your license plate, you might even want to think about trying to get a personalized license plate in your state that says the same thing. It'd be interesting to see where you get them in all 50 states. Sally sent me this listener. The license plate is the letter M followed by the word peach followed by the letter W. And it just if you just look at it all as together, it's M-P-E-A-C-H-W. Right? It looks like it's gibberish, but if you slow down, it's M-Peach W. Oh, yeah. Okay. So, I thought that was kind of cool. Mark in Michigan sent me a note. He's talking about they died so Republicans could take the Senate, about this piece that I wrote for Common Dreams. And that I've been saying here on the air now for I don't know how long, 6 months, a year, something like that, at least, that in my opinion, since the elections of 2002, it's been pretty obvious to me that the whole point of the invasion of Iraq and the subsequent occupation of Iraq, it not being a war since they never attacked us, it simply being an invasion and an occupation, the whole point of the invasion and occupation of Iraq was to help the Republicans gain political power in 2002, to take the Senate back, and to gain political power for George W. Bush in 2004. That was the whole point. And so, anyhow, I made the comment, Bill Clinton had sex in the White House with Monica Lewinsky. Congress concluded he'd lied about it to maintain political power, another impeachable crime. And one of our listeners says, I remind you, sir, that in the end, Congress concluded that the president indeed did not lie and was therefore found innocent of any charges which the Republicans insisted were an impeachable offense. Actually, I believe it's rather well established that Bill Clinton lied under oath. He's apologized for it. He's acknowledged it. He was disbarred in Arkansas for it and so forth. What the Senate concluded was not that he did not lie, but that if he did lie, it didn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. He was not convicted of committing a high crime or misdemeanor. See, this is the thing. The Constitution says that there are only three things, or technically, I suppose, four, for which a person could be impeached. And number one is treason. And now, that's an interesting thing, because one of the definitions of treason is desertion during wartime, and one of the definitions of desertion is leaving your unit during war for more than 30 days. And George Bush left his unit and was AWOL. You're only AWOL for the first 30 days. After that, it's desertion. But anyhow, nobody is suggesting that Bush should be impeached because he committed treason way back then. And then, of course, another definition of treason offered by his father, George Bush Sr., was that treason was when somebody outs a CIA agent. Well, you know, so far, nobody is saying that Bush was guilty of that particular treasonous act yet. So far. And, you know, some senior administration official leaked the name of Valerie Plame, you know, a CIA, brought down a CIA operation. And George Bush, of course, telling us that, you know, well, we're not sure we'll ever find that person, but, you know, is it really all that big a deal? I don't know if it's such a big deal, you know. We really shouldn't be concerning ourselves with that, should we?
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, he doesn't have any idea. No idea whatsoever if we're going to find that senior administration official. So that's not an impeachable offense, apparently. So anyhow, we have number one, treason. The second reason that you can be impeached for, and this is reading from the Constitution itself, the second thing that you can be impeached for is bribery. Now, I think it's really interesting that of the three categories of crimes, and the third is high crimes and misdemeanors, the three categories of crimes, you've got treason. Obviously, you know, of course, you'd want to impeach a CEO for treason. Bribery. Now, tell me, if the tobacco industry giving you $10 million and you then giving them $100 billion doesn't constitute bribery, what does? If the pharmaceutical industry giving you millions and millions of dollars and you giving them billions of dollars in legislative favors, shall we say, in Medicare, doesn't constitute bribery, where is our definition? Do we have a definition of bribery any longer? It increasingly seems that we don't. So anyhow, treason, the first thing that you can impeach somebody for. Bribery, the second thing that you can impeach somebody for. And the third thing that you can impeach a president for, according to the Constitution, is high crimes or misdemeanors. And this was Congress's way, or the framers of the Constitution, this was their way of saying, you know, we're really not sure of what crimes the Senate might decide rise to the level of an impeachable offense or not. We're going to leave that to the wisdom of the Senate. So the House of Representatives puts together a bill of impeachment that is basically an indictment. And then the Senate decides whether that indictment is accurate and whether that the crimes contained in it, even if it is accurate, rise to the level of an impeachable offense. In other words, are they, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors, end quote. And misdemeanors, of course, back then in the 1700s, had a different meaning than it did now, than it does now, by and large. I mean, at law, the meaning is the same. But the vulgar usage, the common usage today when we say misdemeanor, more often or not than not, we're talking about jaywalking. We're talking about small crimes. That's not what they meant back then. They meant, you know, major crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors. High crime, in today's language, it would be called high crimes and felonies. So, in fact, what the Senate concluded was that Bill Clinton, whether or not he lied about having sex under oath, that didn't constitute a high crime and misdemeanor in the constitutional sense. That's all. So just to set you straight, Mark, you know, appreciate the feedback, but sorry, that's how it is. The AP posted a story after Republican senators met with President Bush. This from Jason Miner. This from thinkprogress.org, the progressive blog over there. The AP, Jason writes, the AP just posted a story after Republican senators met with President Bush at the White House. If you read the AP's breathless headline, Bush backs Social Security bill without accounts, you might be tempted to think there was a breakthrough in the Social Security stalemate. You might even think, notes Jason, that President Bush, in fact, was being reasonable and willing to negotiate on his top domestic priority, which, of course, is the destruction of Social Security via the poison pill of private accounts. But, says Jason, a quick read of the actual story will quickly dispel that notion. The story cites Utah Senator Bob Bennett, who is introducing two bills in the Senate, one with private accounts and one without. So what kind of compromise is this? And according to the AP, Bennett said when he told Bush of his plans, Bennett said, I like your bill. He didn't say, I like your bill with private accounts, or I like your bill without private accounts. He simply said, I like your bill. Now, that's in the singular. First of all, I think we're overly parsing W's ability to use the language. But nonetheless, he didn't say, I like your bills, both of them. He said, I like your bill. So it must be one of these. In fact, the White House itself walked the story back. No, it's Jason. Jason Miner, the White House spokesman Trent Duffy telling the Associated Press, this in no way should be interpreted to mean that the president is backing off personal accounts. He is not. Then why did the AP headline writers put as a headline, Bush backs Social Security bill without accounts? Why was it a, you know, the big story in the news yesterday? Go figure. See, that's the thing. If a Democrat says something that's at all questionable, oh boy, he gets raked over the coals. He ends up sobbing and apologizing before the United States Senate. If Bush says or does something, a Republican says or does something that's questionable, they get a pass from the media. It's just that simple. They just get a pass because the media are so afraid of the right-wing smear machine. These guys have been working the refs for so long. Working the refs, the old expression from the Bush senior campaign. These guys have been working the referees, right? The referees being the media. They have been on the media for so long that the media is just, they're just scared to death. You know, they do not want to get in the crosshairs of any of the right-wing talk show hosts. They're afraid of it. Or the right-wing media. They don't want the Wall Street Journal editorial page coming after them. Some folks are concerned that Social Security reform is actually a slick way to manipulate the market. This is a growing concern among people in the Wall Street crowd who are concerned that, I mean, most of the folks in Wall Street are looking at personal accounts, private accounts, as, you know, money from heaven. You know, part of that Social Security money is going to end up in the pockets of Wall Street brokers and bankers, and they are just ecstatic about it. They are so looking forward to it. They are so excited about it. But the reality is that there are also a few folks in Wall Street, a few ethical folks, who are a little concerned about, okay, somebody is going to have to define, if people can take part of the Social Security and they can invest in Wall Street, then you can't, it's got to be set up in a way that you can't just, like, give this money to anybody who comes along and says, hi, I'm an investment banker, give me your money. There has to be some protection. And that protection would mean that there has to be some, like, basically certified accounts, some accounts that are approved. You can put money into these three funds that are offered by this particular company, or these five categories of funds that these 20 companies own, that kind of thing. But not, hey, you can give money to that this guy in Ohio who's selling coins. It's a whole other thing, but in any case. Right, you get it. Now, what's going to happen to those approved funds? They're going to go through the roof. So what happens to the companies who want to get their funds approved? They're going to start showing up in Congress, and now we're back to the what is bribery question. They're going to be lobbying, in quotes, saying, oh, make my funds one of the approved funds, because there's billions of dollars, trillions of dollars at stake. And so this could be a real mess. And, of course, in my opinion, that's just what the Bushies would love, and something to end Social Security. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lie down, people. Lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go.
Yes, indeed. It's just too important to have security in the United States that we can't have freedom. Just ask George W. Bush. Turns out now hundreds of libraries are reporting that they have been visited, shall we say, that the Justice Department is shopping around legislation that would require internet service providers to log everything you do and keep the logs for years. That it was just real ID Act was just passed, which is going to mean that sometime in the next 5 years, there's going to be a radio frequency identification chip put in your driver's license so that as you walk by a store, they can scan you from 100 yards away and know who you are, know your Social Security number, know where you live, know what your fingerprint is. that if you're in a demonstration, the police driving by or the Department of Homeland Security or the Republican operatives, they don't have to look for a bumper sticker on your car. They can just scan the crowd and know who you are instantly. This has already gone into law. Yeah, we just, I shouldn't let the bumper music set me off like that. Our telephone number, toll free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. The TomHartman.com is our website. However you spell it will get you there. It is T-H-O-M and Hartman are two N's, but if you misspell it in one of the three or four various ways it can be misspelled, it should all bring you to the same place. And just click live chat if you want to drop into our live chat room and participate in one of the most interesting, thoughtful, insightful, fascinating, fun, occasionally weird and wacky conversations on the whole entire Internet. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Al in Greensburg, Indiana on the line. Hey, Al, what's up?
Hey, Tom, and all this is coming from the small government crowd. That's the funny part about it.
Yeah, it really is the funny part about it, or the tragic part about it, because these guys don't believe in small government at all. They just believe in small social programs.
Right. Hey, the reason I was calling, I've heard a couple stories in the last few days, and I've been a stockbroker, actually, for 20 years, and prior to that worked for Social Security. And I might mention that the private accounts that already exist, such as IRAs, 401ks, and so forth, you can read in many different places, people are not taking advantage of the private accounts they already have.
Right.
So these private accounts that Bush would create is pure nonsense. But a friend of mine got married recently and went to the Social Security office to get her number changed. And while she sat in the lobby waiting to see a representative, she was subjected to a video screen, a television set, that was broadcasting propaganda, basically talking about how, you know, Social Security paid benefits from those who were currently contributing, and when the baby boomers started retiring, there would be a crisis and something would need to be done. And I have heard from other people that they get a similar message, audio message, now when they're on hold.
Right.
And this notion of the government using our taxpayer dollars at these government agencies, as well as hiring these talking heads to basically spread propaganda, is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I just can't understand why people aren't outraged by that.
I am.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people actually are outraged by it. And what's incredible is that an agency of Congress, the General Accounting Office, the General Accountability Office, has concluded that these propaganda films that are not just being generated by the Social Security Administration, there's 35 different agencies in government that are producing these things right now under the Bush policies, that these are illegal, that they're violations of the Smith Act, among other things, and that they are illegal. And yet the Bush administration has said, we're going to continue doing them. Go ahead and stop us. You know, and Congress, of course, isn't going to stop them because Congress is controlled by the Republicans, and all of these propaganda films are to the advantage of the Republicans. So there you have it. I mean, the bottom line, Al, is the only way to solve this problem is to throw the Republicans out of office.
Period. Absolutely.
And that's got to be done in 2006, and that means that we have to start organizing and getting politically active right now. Al, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you in Greensburg, Indiana there. Thank you very much for listening. It's Tom Hartman along with you on the True People's Radio. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. We're checking out. Right now, I was just calling the Social Security Administration. I want to find out what it's saying on hold. We'll just put it on the air and let you hear it as well. Should be entertaining. Our number 1-866-889-8894. Alan in Trumansburg, New York, on the line. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
If we were somehow able to get George and Dick out, number three would be Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, most likely, right?
Yeah, it depends on how it's done. Actually, no. Nancy Pelosi is not the Speaker of the House. Denny Hastert is the Speaker of the House.
I know. Oh, right. I should have said we have to get Dick and George and take over the House.
Yeah.
At that point,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but if you look back at the Nixon impeachment, I mean, it would have been an impeachment had he not resigned. It's why he resigned, obviously. But had that, I mean, we ended up with Jerry Ford and Nelson Rockefeller, neither of whom had been elected. And, you know, this because when Spiro Agnew left, Nixon appointed Ford, and it could be that Cheney is more vulnerable to impeachment, frankly, than Bush is, because Cheney was the one who was running down to the basement of the CIA throughout this whole thing, you know, cooking the books. And so if that's the crime, you know, you impeach Cheney first, and then they've got to appoint a new vice president, and where does that person come from? And then if the president leaves, then whoever replaced Cheney would be. So you could have a repeat of the Nixon's, you know, I mean, it started out Nixon Agnew and you know, ended up Ford Rockefeller. Nobody voted for either one of them, other than in the local districts of Michigan and New York.
I think they're both pretty vulnerable, and apparently John Conyers and the crew there this last week seemed to think so too. So I was kind of looking at it kind of like a campaign strategy going into the 06 elections. Maybe we ought to print out bumper stickers that say Nancy Pelosi 06.
Yeah, there you go.
You know,
there you go.
Because people are getting sick of it. There's swing in the
really
right
are.
Direction, and, yeah. and it might really
in the correct direction.
Yeah, it might bring a lot of people out to the polls that might not normally come on an off year.
Yeah, I hope so, Alan. I really hope that you're right. And I thank you for calling. This is really the key to the whole thing. Is if we can take back either the House or the Senate, or ideally both. And frankly, I think it's going to be easier for Democrats to take back the Senate than the House, because the House has been so gerrymandered. But, you know, time will tell. We'll see what happens. But if we can take back the House or the Senate or both, then in 2006, you know, 18 months from now, more or less, you know, 16 months, you know, I don't have a clock, you know, a counter in front of me, but, you know, it's not that far down the road, then there's a good chance that, you know, Bush could be toast. And, you know, because impeachment could happen. There actually, you know, could be something serious done about, you know, the high crimes and misdemeanors that are being committed by the White House. And the question is, will we take it back? And frankly, I mean, they knew this in 2002. This is a very sophisticated operation to lie us into this war. It is a very sophisticated operation to get us into this war. And they did it. And they used that to take back the Senate in 2002, and arguably with some success. Those who believe that the voting machines had nothing to do with it would say that the reason that Max Baucus, for example, is the senator from Georgia instead of Max Cleland, Saxby Chambliss, the reason Saxby Chambliss is the senator from Georgia instead of Max Cleland is because you know, Bush lied us into this war, and he was ginning it up a month before the election. I mean, keep in mind, the Downing Street memo. You go back, I mean, this is where you go back to the Downing Street memo. And the Downing Street memo said, you know, this is scheduled to come out in the month before the congressional elections. Right? I mean, it's just right there, right? Here's the exact language. Oh, no, I don't have it. I'm sorry. I don't have it right in front of me. But that was the... Oh, here it is. The absolute smoking gun. No decision had been taken, but the thought most likely... But he thought the most likely timing in U.S. minds for military action to begin was January, with the timeline beginning 30 days before the congressional elections. So this is, you know, quoting the defense secretary. Here's the quote. The defense secretary said the U.S. has already begun spikes of activity to put pressure on the regime. This was the, you know, illegal increases in the bombings. No decision had been taken, but he thought, Rumsfeld, thought the most likely timing in U.S. minds for military action to begin was January, with the timeline beginning 30 days before the U.S. congressional elections. Now that's in the Downing Street Memorandum, the 23rd of July Downing Street Memorandum. That was first published in the United States in the New York Review of Books. I mean, that's you want a smoking gun. It's a smoking cannon. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Paul in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I will be on Friday at the Celebration Cinema, where people can come in from the heat and enjoy the air conditioning and hang out with us while we do our live program. Hey, Rick.
supposed to be about 92 on Friday.
That's what I understand. So it should be a perfect day to be indoors in an air conditioned. It's in a shopping center there, the Celebration Cinema.
Yeah.
And you know, a nice place to hang out. I did the show from there, as I recall, it was last year.
Well, I wanted to briefly touch on something before my main reason for calling. When you mentioned the thing about Clinton lying under oath and it not being a high crime, I guess the real point to me, and I'm not a lawyer, but was that lying under oath, if you're doing it, is not the same as perjury. Perjury is lying about something, and the term is germane, I guess. And so, you know, I don't want to rehash all that because that's ancient history, but I just kind of want to get my thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, and the other thing about lying under oath is that Bill Clinton was talking about sex, which is not part of his official job duties.
Exactly.
And so the oath under which he was lying, that he was violating, was the oath to speak truthfully to the grand jury. On the other hand, George W. Bush took an oath of office. To serve and protect the United States and the Constitution. And that oath of office, he was acting under when he lied us into this war. And so George Bush has lied under oath, under his oath of office.
Okay, but what I wanted to mention was this story about these National Guardsmen who were talking about Hussein, and I guess it's in the new issue of Gentleman's Quarterly.
Yeah.
Well, it so happens that a local radio station here was talking about that, and the two hosts and the folks calling in were ready to court-martial these young men. And I guess, you know, I could give my opinion. I just wonder what you and maybe the rest of the listeners might think. How in the world can this even be considered remotely treasonous? All they're doing is saying that the guy liked Reagan, which should be a good mark for him. He sort of liked Clinton. He hated the two Bushes, which is understandable. He likes to eat a certain cereal and doesn't like another one.
Yeah.
I mean, can anyone tell me how that is even remotely treasonous?
Well, it's not at all treasonous. What it is, however, is bad for the Bush administration because, number one, it characterizes Saddam Hussein as a human being. And in order to have a really true supervillain,
right.
And this is you got to keep in mind the strategy, the psychological strategy here. You can't have, you know, Batman would only be a bad comic book if there were no, you know, jugglers or jokers, you know, if there weren't supervillains.
Sure,
Superman
sure.
Without Lex Luthor would be incredibly boring. Here's this guy with these superpowers. He can go, you know, jump over tall buildings. So what? I mean, you know, but you have to have a supervillain in order to have a superhero. It's the first rule of drama. And Bush and Rove understood that. And so Bush has to create in the minds of the American people the perception that Saddam Hussein is some sort of incredible supervillain. Not that he's a third-rate piker of a third-world country whose Air Force had been destroyed, whose army was in tatters. You know, instead Bush is out there going, he's got the second-largest army in the world. I mean, come on, give me a break. The guy was a piker. He was a joke. He had no weapons of mass destruction. He had nothing. And the problem is, from the Bush administration's point of view, is that if these soldiers start making Saddam Hussein look like what he really is, which is just another schmuck dictator, you know, with his personal idiosyncrasies, then Super George doesn't look like Super George anymore. Super George begins looking like, you know, the bully, the neighborhood bully, the biggest nation in the world with the most powerful and sophisticated military, took out a third world, you know, a third-rate dictator in a third world country. And that's just not good for the propaganda machine. And that's why guys on the right wing are all upset about it. I mean, it's just very, very simple. Paul in Santa Fe, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to make a comment about the sad case of Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois.
Yes, sir.
And his
apology.
I didn't see the whole thing. I saw, you know, little blurbs of it on TV news, but I mean, he basically just bent over and said, how many whacks? You know, it was just very, I guess I've lost a great deal of respect from him, and certainly he was not a profile in courage. I mean, I realize it's a very complicated issue, but, you know, thank God.
He stood up to it for a week, you know,
yeah.
And that's the thing. What amazes me is that he stood up to it as long as he did, because the pressure that the right wing can bring down on anybody in this country nowadays, because they own so much of the media, so much of the media are just absolutely sucking up to them. I mean, you see these commentators on these cable talk shows and even on the national news taking what Durbin said out of context, quoting him, mischaracterizing what he said, misquoting him out of context. And, you know, it just reached the point where everybody in America thought he had said something that was not what he said. And so he, you know, basically he had the choice of continually trying to explain for himself, which is always a lose-lose strategy, particularly in politics, and losing his own senatorial seat. I mean, the people in Illinois were beginning to turn against him because they're watching the same media everybody else is. Or, you know, as you said, you know, bending over and saying, you know, how many whacks would you like to take, sir? And so he chose the latter. He, you know, to just kind of close the discussion. And probably politically it was the right thing for him to do. Although, you know, once again, the Reich Wing has had another media victory here, and I think it's a tragedy. Paul, thanks a lot for the call and for raising the issue. It's a good and important one. Oh, we have Social Security on hold. That's interesting. Is this?
Here's a new service we're glad to be able to tell you about. It's our online benefit application.
This is the Social Security Administration.
Benefits, spouses' benefits, and disability benefits.
Now that's not the good part.
At your convenience.
Did you hear a juicy part, Scott?
Our website at
www.socialsecurity.gov. Okay. We'll see if we get back around to it.
That's www.socialsecurity.gov.
Let's see if it just cycles right now. Come on. One, two, three. Yeah, this is it. Playing elevator music on a radio show is not a good plan. Okay, I'm going to put the Social Security Administration.
Information about Social Security. Why not subscribe to e-news?
I'm going to put them back on hold. We'll come back periodically and check them out and see how they're doing. Jerry in Colorado on the line. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hi. You know, regarding Mr. Senator Durbin, I have to say I respect him, first of all, for saying what he said. And it doesn't hurt my feelings that somebody does what they need to do to save themselves, as long as it's halfway respectable.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe some people honestly did mistake it. I think they're idiots if they did, or only heard part of the story.
Yeah, I don't think that Dick Durbin caving in was anything as bad as, for example, Joe Biden voting for the bankruptcy bill.
Yeah.
I mean, that's caving in that is going to harm America.
It really takes a man and honestly acknowledge the possibility that he did. I'm looking to put together a bumper sticker for some time. I'm looking to try and make one, you know, concise. And I think I've heard it from you this morning. This impeach Bush is a part of it. And then on top of it, 1,700 plus and still counting.
Yeah. Although, a month from now it'll be 1,800. I just think Bush lied and people died, or Clinton lied and nobody died. That's one that causes people to have to really frame the context and go, oh wow, you know, Clinton lied and nobody died. That's a bumper sticker for you.
You got to be right, because that way nobody can come back and say you're taking advantage of the people that are dying or something like that.
There you go.
You know, but regarding this next election, frankly, anybody that, I don't care who it is, in the Senate or the House, that doesn't stand up and admit that they were duped into supporting this role and acknowledging that it was a mistake, needs to be really seriously be considered for voting out.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Jerry, and it's well said and a good point. And thank you for calling. I appreciate it. Matthew in Cincinnati on the line. Hey, Matthew, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to briefly comment about Condoleezza Rice's comment on other countries' lack of funding and the irony of the G8 summit that's going to be going on in a few weeks here. And I was curious about what your thoughts were on that.
Okay, specifically, what are you talking about?
I think she made a speech yesterday or the day before about encouraging other countries that the United States has been involving.
Are you talking about our funding for Africa for AIDS?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's incredibly cynical for her to say those kinds of things. Yes, we have promised to pay $15 billion for AIDS, and it's a huge commitment. And if we were going to follow through on it, it would be marvelous. But the reality is that we've only spent a few hundred million dollars of that, and even that has had such huge strings on it that it's been largely useless. I mean, it's an absolute tragedy. And so for them to try and politicize these things is just awful. Thank you for the call, though, and I appreciate your listening to us there in Cincinnati, presumably on Radio Free Ohio. Tony in Waukegan, Illinois on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, a couple of things. I watched the thing last night on our local news and with Dick Durbin, and it was frankly just disturbing to me. I mean, it really was. I sat there and I watched him
grovel.
It wasn't even, it was below groveling. I swear. I felt as if somebody had just taken out a baseball bat and beaten me over the back of my head.
Well, see, that's how he felt. I'm telling you, he's been the victim of the right-wing smear machine. And the right-wing smear machine can destroy people politically. They're trying to do it to Hillary now. They've got this new book out that implies that she's a lesbian, that Bill raped her in order to conceive Chelsea and all this other stuff. And Sean Hannity is like putting these people on his radio show.
But, Tom, giving, basically doing what he did is not going to help him. It doesn't matter. I mean, isn't there anything that we've learned from watching these guys and do their work the last few years? It doesn't matter what we say. It doesn't matter what we do. They are going to go for us. No
oh,
matter
I,
what.
I agree.
Like, it's just like
and I've been saying all along, Dick Durbin, please don't apologize.
Well, yes.
But he's not listening to me.
And see, this is the problem. If he had done a Howard Dean, that is, I said what I said, go back and listen to it, you make your own decision.
Yeah.
I guarantee you, Dick Durbin is loved here in Illinois, and he's going no place.
Yeah, well, it's a shame, and I'm sorry to hear that, Tony. Tony, thanks for the call and for the update from Illinois. That's, you know, I sure hope that Dick Durbin, oh, you mean he's going no place, as in he will get reelected. Great, that's good to hear. Tony, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
All that you touch and all that you see, all that you taste, all you feel.
And welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman with you on your radio home for democracy, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Matt in Kansas on the line. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Just something I heard. I've been very concerned about when this situation in the Middle East will end. I know Trent Lott is no longer the majority leader, but he said something on one of the Federalist radio programs this morning that alarmed me. He was talking with the host about how all these insurgents now are coming in from Iran and from Syria, and he made the statement, I'm not saying we should go into Syria or Iran right now, but we're going to go get them wherever they're at.
Yeah, this is they're setting us up. I've been saying for a year now, I mean, if you've been listening to the program, I've been saying that, and I'm going to pot you down here, Matt. Thank you for the call, actually. I appreciate it. I have been saying ever since, well, at least a year, that Syria is going to be next. Syria will be the war for 2006, and Iran will be the war for 2008. That he needs, that Bush needs a small war. I think, you know, Syria is not that big a military threat to us, frankly. He needs a small war for 2006. You know, it's sort of like Reagan with his Grenada War to distract people from the Iran-Contra scandal, speaking of treason. And he's going to need a larger war in 2008, and that will be Iran. And, of course, Iran will be very messy if they decide to do that. It'd be an absolute tragedy. Frank in Phoenix, Arizona on the line. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? You know, I'm not really looking for impeachment, but if the impeachment process happens, won't it stop the policies and things and keep Bush busy with that, like they did with Clinton?
That's the whole point of it, Frank.
That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah, that's really the whole point of it, and that's what they did with Clinton, and that's what needs to be done. Yeah, although, you're going to have to take the House or the Senate. Joe in Nebraska by truck. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you're just so topical, man. I called Durbin's office and told him, you know, what you did was so right on, and it was such a shame that you didn't stand the ground because we need it desperately out here. I feel like I'm not a scholar of, but I've been really researching pre-World War II Germany, you know,
yeah.
And not to get off the top of it, over the top of it. By golly, I'm looking at all of the secrecy and the media control.
Oh, now, it's absolutely incredible. You look at the enabling acts. I'm sorry, Joe, we're out of time, but the point that you're making is solid, and I've written about it on the web, a piece called When Democracy Failed. It's also a chapter in my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, about, you know, how Hitler got through the enabling acts, which, you know, with a four-year sunset provision, just like the Patriot Act. It's like history is repeating itself. It's a truly scary thing. I'm Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
We'll be right back.
uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Iraqi lawmakers. Now, these are the legally empowered representatives of Iraq, right? We had elections. George Bush opposed the elections, but Sistani and Sadr insisted on them. Made it clear if we didn't have elections, if we were going to do the caucus system that Bush and Bremer were pushing for, that there was going to be, we were going to have big problems. So they had elections. And these are the folks, according to the UN Security Council, that now run the country. The UN Security Council has said on May 31st, there was the UN Security Council kind of retroactively made legal what we did in Iraq. Because what we did was a violation of Resolution 1441, the one that authorized force in Iraq, said that that force in Iraq can only happen if one of the weapons inspectors, either Hans Blix or Mohammed al-Baradei, say, yes, there are weapons of mass destruction, he's covering them up, he's lying to us. Never happened. In fact, Blix and al-Baradei were saying, you know, increasingly it's looking like there's nothing here. We're not seeing any evidence of it. You'd have to have, for a major weapons program, certainly for a nuclear weapons program, you'd have to have an industrial infrastructure, and the industrial infrastructure in this country has been devastated by 8-9 years of sanctions. There's nothing here. They don't have the ability to manufacture these weapons. They haven't imported them from anybody. Anything that they might have had that they would have bought from Don Rumsfeld back when, under the Jerry Ford administration, the Reagan administration, when Rumsfeld was going over there visiting with them and shaking hands with Saddam Hussein, any of those weapons that they bought back then for the Iran-Iraq war would have degraded by this point. There's nothing here. So we went back on May 31st, or the UN went back on May 31st and said, okay, the U.S. illegally invaded Iraq, but we're going to say that it's okay. As long as they leave once the political process has been completed. This is the UN resolution of May 31st, and this, I think, might have something to do with why Bush wants to get us out of the UN. Right, because the UN has required us to leave Iraq, quote, let me reverse it. The UN has said we can only stay in Iraq, quote, until the completion of the political process, end quote. Unless the Iraqi government specifically requests that we stay. Well, here's where it gets interesting. 82 lawmakers representing Shiite, Kurdish, Sunni Arab, Christian, and communist deputies. These are members of the parliament. 82 of them sent a letter to Falah Hassan Shanshal of the United Iraqi Alliance. That's the largest group in parliament. And to the Speaker of Parliament, Hajem El Hassani. And this letter said, please, please. Well, actually, here's the quote. In the letter, Shanshal said the 275-member parliament was the Iraqi people's legitimate representative and the guardian of their interests, quote, we have asked in several sessions for occupation troops to withdraw, the letter said. Our request was ignored. You get this? The Iraqi parliament has asked us to withdraw, and we have ignored their request. They go on to say in their letter, quote, it is dangerous that the Iraqi government has asked the UN Security Council to prolong the stay of occupation forces without consulting representatives of the people who have the mandate for such a decision. End of quote. They went on to say, therefore, we must reject the occupation's legitimacy and renew our demand for these forces to withdraw. So here we have 82 members of the Iraqi parliament asking us to withdraw. You have over 90% of the Iraqi people now viewing Americans as occupiers, not liberators. You have a homegrown Iraqi bomb force that has come about. Now, I mean, the fact that they're having to advertise this, I mean, this is pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. You've got now, in Iraq, a local al-Qaeda group that has sprung up. See, this is what Bush's foreign policy has done. He's made Osama bin Laden an international hero, and he's been the recruiting tool, the best recruiting tool Al-Qaeda could have ever asked for. I mean, Bush has done exactly what Iran wanted. Iran wanted Saddam Hussein out of Iraq. He's gone. They wanted a Shiite government in Iraq. It's on its way. He's done exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted. Osama bin Laden wanted Saddam Hussein out of Iraq. Because he was a secularist. He did not, you know, he didn't, the women could vote. They didn't have to wear veils and things. Well, Osama bin Laden got what he wanted. And Osama bin Laden wanted the whole world to recognize him as a great leader of Islam. Before Bush decided to declare war on him, or on terrorism, excuse me, and elevate Osama to the level of folk hero, Osama was just reviewed as a small-time psychopathic criminal with a relatively small organization compared to some in the world. I mean, they were estimating, the CIA was estimating 20,000 people in Al-Qaeda. There's probably now a billion people. Well, not that many. There's certainly hundreds of millions of people around the world now who view Osama bin Laden as a hero. And prior to George Bush invading Iraq, they didn't. But, you know, he started this whole series of things, this whole series of actions in progress, and here we are. So now in Iraq, there is a homegrown insurgency that is advertising itself as Iraqis. You know, Iraqi suicide bombers for Iraq. We ain't got no foreign fighters here. You know, I keep asking the question, okay, where are the foreign fighters? Everybody's saying, well, they're coming in from Syria, they're coming in from Iran, they're coming in from Saudi Arabia. How come we haven't captured any? Seems we just keep killing Iraqis. Don't you think that if they captured a single Saudi Arabian or a single, just one Iranian captive, that's all it would take. One terrorist from Iran found in Iraq. And they would be trotting that guy around on the talk shows, or whoever caught him would be trotted around on the talk shows the same way as the guys who caught Saddam. Oh, look at we caught. Here's this. These are the guys coming in from. Yeah. And so now there's this group in Iraq that is saying that they are recruiting Iraqi suicide bombers in Iraq, and that it's all about Iraq, and it's got nothing to do with any other country. And it sure appears that, you know, they're right. This is. A homegrown insurgency. Well, enough on that. I don't want to just, you know, drone on here about Iraq. I think it's important that we get it. But just, I'd like to talk about economics for a few minutes. This is where it really hits all of us. This is, you know, ultimately, you know, the stuff that is important, the pocketbook stuff. David Obey has attached a bill to the 2006 Treasury Postal Bill. The 2006 Treasury Postal Bill is the appropriation for, you know, to fund the post office for the year 2006. This is something that's going to have to pass, right? They're not going to shut down the post office because they don't like what David Obey has to say. And so he's attached this thing. Now, in conference committee, it's already passed the House, it's already passed the Senate. So you would think, because he's attached it and it's passed the House and the Senate, that it'll survive. It may not, because now it goes into conference committee, and in conference committee, anything can happen. And the thing that he has attached is a piece of legislation that would require that if a credit card company is going to jack up your interest rates, that they do that based solely on your interactions with that particular credit card company. Because what's happening now is these credit card companies are advertising like crazy. Hey, move your balance from that high interest card to our card. Our card has only, you know, 0% or 3% or 6% or a maximum of 9% or whatever. And you read the fine print and it says, as long as your credit is good, or some words to that effect. And you pay your bills on time, you know, assiduously, just absolutely. And you're a week late with your car payment, which has nothing to do with your credit card. But these companies now are sharing information so instantaneously and in such detail that if you're a day late on your car payment Your credit card company knows about it within an hour. And no longer qualifies for the 3% or 6% credit card. We're now going to start charging you 21%. And then they do it in kind of a sneaky way because they don't raise the monthly payments. They just start adding that interest into the principal. So people are making a $27 a month payment or a $135 a month payment or whatever it is, and they notice that their payment might have gone up 15 cents or something, and they're not reading the fine print. They're not looking at all the little boxes, and they're not noticing that their APR, their average percentage rate, has gone up, or their annual percentage rate, that the interest rate on their credit card has gone up. And so David Obey says, if you're going to jack up the interest rate on somebody's credit card, you can only do that if it's because they paid the credit card late. And it's going to be really interesting when this Treasury Postal Bill emerges from conference committee to see if this amendment has been stricken, have got off at Congress. It's going to be fascinating to find out. I have a feeling this is not going to survive. You know what? Pro-consumer legislation. Now, at the same time, in today's Wall Street Journal, Standards & Poor's Rating Services, responding to a loosening of mortgage lending standards, said the risks of defaults are growing for some types of home loans. Now, they're quite concerned about this. And see, what's happening is that these home mortgages are being consolidated into giant lumps. You know, here's $1 million, here's $100 million, here's $1 billion worth of home mortgages, and then they're bought and sold. And so your mortgage will be sold from company to company to company. And the concern that Standard & Poor's has, these are the rating service, the concern that they have is that adjustable rate mortgages are not as safe. They're not as secure. They're not as stable as a fixed mortgage. In other words, people are more likely to default on them if interest rates go up and suddenly their payments spike. They can't make the payments anymore. And they point out, and here's where it gets really spooky. This just absolutely spooked me. A recent report from UBS AG said that more than 40% of prime-rated mortgage loans pooled into securities recently have been option ARMs, up from less than 1% 2 years ago. And Standard & Poor's is starting to say, wait a minute, guys, you're going to have to calculate these risks differently because this is scary, right? This is scary. And so, you know, word of the wise, be careful. Be careful of the home housing market and pay careful attention to the kind of mortgage that you have. Now is a good time to lock in a rate. If you have an adjustable mortgage, roll it into a fixed rate as fast as you can. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
So, hey, there's a new American way. No one's serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, and historically we've always said don't mess with the USA, don't attack us, but Iraq didn't attack us. This goes beyond that. This is not muscle flexing. This is Bush exploiting us, invading a country that had nothing to do with us or attacking us, purely for political gain. Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in Washington today?
Okay, well, it's been very interesting because the president this morning gave a speech where he talked about private accounts again with Social Security. And this morning, Chuck Schumer of New York and Senator Baucus of Montana had a press conference to call on Bush basically to drop Social Security privatization. And they basically said, look, privatization is still the problem. And the fact that Senator Bennett has a plan that says that he's going to put forth a plan that says he will not put privatization, he's going to essentially split it into two bills, one privatization and one just plain fix Social Security. And what they said is, listen, do not be dissuaded by this bait and switch kind of thing, because essentially if they allow a Social Security bill to go through, and then what they can easily do is in conference committee, they can put the privatization in and essentially get it through that way, because you cannot amend a conference bill.
So when something comes out of conference committee, it has to go back to the House and Senate to be re-voted on, does it not?
That's right.
And they can. And so they just shoot it down, wouldn't they?
That's right. Well, the Democrats would not shoot it down because you can't amend the bill.
Oh, they'd have to filibuster it.
They'd have to, that's right. They'd either have to filibuster it, and I'm not exactly sure what happens on, I guess you can on that kind of bill. The problem is they said that they would attach it to a bill, with the Social Security that would have everything else but the kitchen sink in it, so that the Democrats really then would look like they were stopping things. So I said to, Senator Schumer this morning, I said, hey, look, the Democrats, Scott McClellan this morning was just saying, well, the Democrats are putting a giant stop sign on this. And he said, look, the people that are putting a giant stop sign on this are the American people. They don't want private accounts. They don't want what it's going to do to the economy. And, you know, the White House, he gave an interesting analogy. He said, it doesn't matter whether it's three packs to one pack of nicotine. It's still nicotine, and it's still bad.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter how you sort of, you know, whether you say, well, it's not going to cost.
Well, the reality is that the private accounts are a poison pill. They're in there to destroy Social Security over time.
That's right.
To eventually replace it. I mean, this is their goal, is to privatize Social Security, period, ultimately.
Exactly. Also, Senator Lautenberg this morning sent a letter to President Bush saying that since the CIA chief has a very good idea, excellent idea, when Bin Laden is hiding, why don't we just go get him? And so he sent that
Porter letter. Porter Goss, in open mouth, insert foot.
Exactly. Then there is, of course, the issue of the energy bill. And it's interesting. Now they're saying, okay, Debbie Stabenow and Byron Dorgan said, why don't we have an amendment to the energy bill that would require a formal investigation by the Federal Trade Commission as to whether gasoline prices are artificially being manipulated, a la Enron, and whether people are really being price gouged?
Yeah. And why don't we?
A very good question.
We won't, because the Republicans are in charge.
Right. Also, another U-2 spy plane went down in Southeast Asia. It was doing some spy work around the Iraq area. It's based, I believe, in Qatar. And, you know, U-2 spy planes are they're very accident-prone because, as you know, our military correspondent was a U-2 pilot.
Yeah. Yeah, and then
And her spy plane crashed, actually. She survived the crash.
Yes, I remember talking to her about it. That's remarkable. Well, I'm you know, thank you for the update, Ellen. And thanks for
thank
the report
you.
From Washington, D.C. Good to talk to you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, 29 minutes past
good
the
news
hour.
About...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It was a slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Glad to be back with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hello or participate in the message board, the online blog, as it were. And share your thoughts with others, or hear what other people have to say, or read it, or see it, or sense it, or experience it, whatever, you know, whatever may be your choice. Freeman in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Freeman, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I got two quick things. One, I think I can win this What Has George Bush Done That Benefits We the People Over We the Corporations contest.
Okay. Our two-year-long running contest, 2.5 years.
Starting next year, the tax cut for the large SUVs will no longer be.
And this was a particular piece of legislation that was put into place by Republicans?
No, it was put into place by Clinton, you know, that basically you get the tax cut for SUVs, and now the Bush is undoing it.
Freeman, And Bush's now the legislation that undoes the SUV tax cut was put into place by Republicans and signed by George Bush?
It's signed by George Bush. I don't know who put it into place.
Yeah, well, see, this is the qualifier here. Here's the contest. And that's why I'd started this with Tom Tancredo. You know, I'd asked him, he's a member of Congress from Colorado, and I'd said, you know, Congressman Tancredo, can you name one piece of legislation that has originated with the Republicans and been signed into law, you know, has passed through the Republican House and Senate and been signed into law by George Bush, whose primary beneficiary is we the people rather than some corporation someplace or some special interest group, and he's been unable to. And so, you know, I'd like to know a little bit about the pedigree on that. Freeman, you know, drop me an email.
Yeah, I'll let you know. Okay. So my other thing was, you mentioned that one letter about the Iraqi deputies saying their request was ignored for us to withdraw.
Right.
It seems a little misleading because the majority of the deputies didn't sign the letter, so the majority of them don't want us to withdraw.
That's right.
It seemed misleading to say, you know, our request was ignored. Well, you know, their request was not the request of the majority.
Okay.
So it just seems,
point taken.
Yeah.
Point
Alrighty.
Taken. I thought I had specifically said it was 82 members.
You did, but I didn't. When I heard you, at least I didn't hear that it was.
That's not the majority. Okay. In fact, do you know the number of members of the House of the Iraqi Parliament?
I found that one. I found the letter you were reading. It looks like it was 275.
275. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, good to get that straight on the record.
Well
said. My point, and thank you, Freeman. I appreciate it. My point was, you know, if 82 people are saying this in the legislature, that it's not just, you know, an occasional bomb thrower. It's not just the loony person on the street. It's not just, you know, the crazy Iraqi. That this is a growing sentiment in Iraq, and it's one that we're going to have to reckon with. And we're not planning on reckoning with it. I mean, we're building the largest embassy there in the world. $1 billion we're going to put into this thing. We're building several, 17, 18, 19, depending on whose numbers you're using, of huge military bases. And the day may come when the rest of Iraq says the same thing that these 80-some-odd members of the Iraqi parliament have said, which is, hey, please, leave. And what are we going to do? I don't, you know, it's not a good situation, frankly, that George Bush has gotten us into. I'd like to move along. The Tulsa Zoo, there was a story a week or two ago, maybe 3 weeks ago. I shared it with you on this program about how the Tulsa Zoo had an elephant. And actually has a couple of elephants, an elephant exhibit. But over the elephant exhibit, there is a statue of an elephant. And it has a name on it that says Ganesh. And that's all it says about it. There's not a whole... Now, Ganesh is one of the Hindu gods. Or, you know, one of the traditional Hindu deities, shall we say. And he's the elephant god, as it were. And I realize for Hindus listening that, you know, I'm terribly... this is not the sophisticated, here's the details, here's the inside skinny on Hinduism answer. But in any case, Ganesh is the Hindu elephant god, or a god that takes the shape of an elephant in large part. And that's all it says. There isn't even a description of who Ganesh is, or what his history is, or where he came from, or why the Hindus revere him, or anything. It's just, you know, it's the elephant's thing, and they put a statue of an elephant there, and it's the elephant god, and they said, you know, it's Ganesh. And it's kind of cool, isn't it? I mean, here's the elephant exhibit, and there's a part of the world where, you know, elephants are gods. Well, Dan Hicks and John Jones, who visit the Tulsa Zoo with their children, said that they didn't want to see religious icons at the zoo. They said, we need to leave that to the, the zoo should simply be a display of animals. And so, you know, they went to the zoo and said, not take down the Hindu god, but instead put up a Christian god. Put up something about our, you know, their particular sect of Christianity. And the zoo said, no. You know, the Tulsa Zoo said the belief that God has created the animals has no scientific merit, and that's why it's not mentioned at the zoo. See, what they wanted was a thing on creationism. Brett Fiddler of the Tulsa Zoo said, "We display things that have been proven through the scientific method, and intelligent design has not been proven to the point that it belongs in an institution like the Tulsa Zoo." Okay? And, you know, I suppose probably if push came to shove, they would have taken the Ganesh sign off the elephant statue or even taken off the elephant statue, but they're not going to put up a creationism exhibit. This really wasn't about Ganesh. This was really about these guys wanting creationism to be there. So then, you know, this story, I shared the story with you, what, 3 weeks ago, a couple weeks ago, and a week or so ago, actually on June, must have been around June 15th, there was a story about how the zoo in Tulsa has now put up a creationism exhibit. How the world was created 6,000 years ago, and how it can be scientifically proven, and you know, all that fossil stuff. Don't pay attention to that. That's not real. And you know, blah de blah de blah. And so the world, the entire universe is only 6,000 years old. Period. The Tulsa Zoo put it up. So I sent an email to the curator of the Tulsa Zoo. And it's just a one-sentence email. Didn't say who I am or anything. I just said, please tell me it's a joke that you're putting a religious tract up as a zoo exhibit. And signed it Tom Hartman, period. And I got an email back from somebody presumably at the Tulsa Zoo saying, "Mr. Hartman, thank you for your email. The display of creation theories at the Tulsa Zoo and Living Museum was voted on by the City of Tulsa Parks Board, which serves as a governing body for the zoo. This was not a zoo decision. Under the Parks Board direction, the zoo will be developing a new culture-based display that will encompass several widely held concepts on the origin of our world. This display will serve as an addition to the zoo's Time Gallery exhibit that shows a science-based description of the origin of our universe and our planets." And the zoo director, Stephen Walker, sent this to me. And then he said, "I would suggest you direct your comments to the Mayor's Action Center at mac@cityoftulsa.org. And so I did. I sent an email to the mayor at the email address mac@cityoftulsa.org and said, you know, is it serious? Is it true that you are going to put up a religious display in the zoo about creationism? And I have yet to receive a response." But, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. Here we had, day before yesterday, Congressman John Hotstetler. He's a Republican from Indiana. He stood on the floor of the House of Representatives and said, and I quote, "Like a moth to a flame, Democrats can't help themselves when it comes to denigrating and demonizing Christians," end quote. You get this? John Hostetler saying, "Democrats can't help themselves when it comes to denigrating and demonizing Christians." Say what? I would bet that the vast majority of Democrats in the House and Senate are Christians. In fact, I'll bet that the vast majority of Democrats in the United States are Christians. But the cons, they are declaring a religious war. It's a jihad. It's like the Osama bin Ladens of America. I mean, this is truly scary. During the election, Republicans in West Virginia. This, by the way, from the Center for American Progress, American Progress blog. During the election, from thinkprogress.org, Republicans in West Virginia and Arkansas were caught mailing out flyers that said liberals wanted to ban the Bible. The pamphlets actually featured a photo of a Bible with a big red "banned" stamped across the front. Now, nobody had ever suggested banning the Bible. They just made it up. I thought one of the Christian values was not to lie. I mean, it's one of the Ten Commandments, don't bear false witness. After the election, Jerry Falwell said that Americans who didn't vote for George Bush did not take the Bible seriously. He also said on CNN, the Democrats were a, quote, anti-God, anti-Christ, on an anti-God, anti-Christ, and anti-religion kick, end quote. Rush Limbaugh, certainly a man of great faith, after his multiple wives and his drug addiction. Who knows? Maybe he's found God. Anyhow, Rush Limbaugh says, liberals don't like God. You know, I have to say, as a Christian myself, I am offended by this. Evangelical leader Bob Jones told conservatives, quote, you owe liberals nothing. They despise you because they despise your Christ, end quote. I'm sorry, the progressive and liberal values on which this country was founded and which have sustained this country from its founding up until the time that Ronald Reagan began chipping away at them are fundamentally Christian values. You go back, I mean, there's one place in the Bible where Jesus actually says to his disciples, hey, here's the one way to get into heaven. It's in the 25th chapter of Matthew. You can go read it. They come to him and they say, how do we get into heaven? He says, on the last days, the king is going to be, you know, sitting, referring to himself. He's going to be sitting on his throne and he's going to be dividing the sheep from the goats. And the sheep, the ones who are going to go to heaven, and the goats are the ones who are going to go to hell. And he says, and the sheep are going to be the ones, he says, and I'll say to them, you know, I'm paraphrasing from memory here. I'll say to them something to the effect of, you know, and you were the ones who fed me when I was hungry and clothed me when I was naked and visited me when I was in prison and gave me water when I was thirsty. And so you, the sheep, you can go to heaven with me, and you, the goats, you didn't. Well, and at that point, the disciples say, But Master, you know, how are we going to get into heaven? Because we never saw you thirsty. We never saw you hungry. We never saw you naked. We never saw you in prison. So how can we get into heaven? Because you just said that the only way to get into heaven is to take care of you when you're in that situation. And Jesus turns to them and says, as you do unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done unto me. And then he turns and then he says, and then the king will say to the goats, you know, you're going to go to, you know, off to hell with you. That's it. Why? Because I was hungry and you did not feed me. I was naked and you did not clothe me. I was in prison. You did not visit me. I was thirsty. You did not give me a drink. I was homeless. You did not give me shelter. And off you go. And again, as you didn't do unto the least of these, you didn't do it to me. This is Christian. And here we have all these right wingers, these multimillionaires, Joe Scarborough, Rush Limbaugh, Jerry Falwell, saying that the Democrats are anti-Christian because they want to have good, strong social security to take care of the least among us. You got, you know, Pat Robertson and Bob Jones saying that Democrats are anti-Christian because they want to make sure that people who work hard for a living have some protection in their old age. The Democrats the logic of this is mind-boggling. What they have done is they have reinvented Christianity to be they've reinvented Jesus as somebody who's in favor of rich white Republicans and who likes war. And it's not the Jesus that I think most Christians know. I don't think the Jesus that most Christians know would ever say that we deserved 9/11. But Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson agree that we did.
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if in fact God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Jerry, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
And I can't believe that the Jesus that I read about in the Bible and that I learned about as a kid and that I feel that I know would ever say that, you know, that we brought about 9/11 on ourselves, that it was our fault because we allow gay people to be gay.
That I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Well, I totally concur. And the problem is we have adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do, and the top people, of course, the court system.
Now, this was 2 days after 9/11. Pat Robertson was laying out the agenda that Bill Frist has been following through on of corrupting the court system. And here you got Jerry Falwell saying, how dare they try to secularize America? Excuse me, the definition of secular is it's a government. The definition of religion is it's a church. If it's about we the people, it is secular. Unless you merge the two, then it's called the Taliban. Well, yeah, that's what these guys want. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Harbin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Come together right
now over me. And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. The American Civil Liberties Union charged on Tuesday that the Bush administration is placing science under siege. This is from the Associated Press. By overzealously tightening restrictions on information, individuals, and technology in the name of Homeland Security. The ACLU said the administration has sought to impose growing restrictions on the free flow of scientific information, unreasonable barriers on the use of scientific materials, and increased monitoring of and restrictions on foreign university students. Science? We don't need no stinking science. That's the official slogan of the Bush administration. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Kate in Arcata, California, on the line. Hey, Kate, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You said that The American system or whatever is essentially based on Christian values, and I would...
No, I didn't say that. I
would agree with that, but I would also say it's essentially Christian values, but not exclusively Christian values.
Yeah, in fact, what I was saying was it's based on the same values that Christianity is based on. These are the
right,
values that you find in every world religion.
I would
be the last person to say America is based on Christianity, because it's not. And Jefferson and the founders made it very clear. Many of them were deists. They were not Christians.
Right.
Or they were Christians... Chino, Christians in name only, but the values that inform Christianity, particularly inform the Jerusalem Church's version of Christianity, which is the disciples of Jesus, versus the Pauline version of Christianity, started by Paul long after Jesus died, which became the Catholic Church and is today modern Christianity. Those early values of the church are the values of America, but they're also the values of Judaism. The idea of tikkun, the tikkun olam, that we're born with an obligation to heal the world. They're the values of Hinduism. They're values in Islam. They're certainly the values of Buddhism.
Yes, so. And it's such an arrogant stance that the right wing takes, or that the Christian fundamentalists take, that Christians are the only ones with so-called Christian values.
Yeah, it's the same stance that Hitler took. I mean, this is keep in mind, when Hitler came to power, one of his first statements was that he was going to bring about a reform of moral values in Germany. And he banned homosexuality, and he put out of business a whole bunch of gay magazines. Just outright banned them, began the persecution of gays, before he was persecuting the Jews. It was just this whole moral values thing is a very dangerous high horse for these folks to be getting on. Kate, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. This is the warning. Are the fascists going to come wearing coonskin caps and talking like Davy Crockett, talking about mom and apple pie? Or are they going to come wearing, crusader outfits and carrying crosses? Or are they going to come, what form are they going to, or is it going to be some mixture of the two? I think Sinclair Lewis was right in when he wrote It Can't Happen Here, a book you ought to go back and read again.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania. beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live 365, American FM on Live365.com, and on WhiteRoseSociety.org, where we're also podcast, and in 29 states and cable systems on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program, and thanks to our many affiliates. Great to have you here. Martin Fishgold, the president of the International Labor Communications Association, called recently for a 2005 meeting to develop a desperately needed national labor media strategy to aid union organizing and counter right-wing media assaults on workers. The ILCA, the International Labor Communications Association, is a 50-year-old group that represents nearly 500 AFL-CIO-affiliated communications organizations and hundreds of independent media groups and individuals, including me. I'm a member, and I encourage you to check out their website, ilcaonline.org. You can join there as well. His call, though, is going beyond the AFL-CIO to all unions and independent labor-centered media. And labor media continues to reach a huge swath of the American public, an estimated 8 million families receiving in print or web news from their labor unions. Marty Fishgold is with us. Hey, Marty.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Great to have you on. The ILCA has just announced this media strategy. I was just sharing from your news release, I guess it is, to help counter the right-wing assault on labor. What's the strategy?
Well, Tom, you know, unions have traditionally stood for the poor and downtrodden, the victims of society, and we need to do that again. But we need to get organized. I mean, right now, the right is light years ahead of us as far as getting their message out. We're not organized. We need the reason why I called to convene this, I mean, because what does this mean for your listeners? What does it mean for the workers out there that we would get organized and get our message out? It means that they will not be bombarded all the time with one point of view, which the right is very has really refined. They're very good at getting their message out in their talk shows and on TV shows, in newspapers. And we in the labor movement and the progressive movement, the independent media, the media for people of color, the media for women, for gays and lesbians, the religious media. I mean, we need to work together to be able to set up a broad network, like a big spider web, that we can get messages out to people and that will resonate with workers in this country. I say two things. One is that the message has to resonate. It has to be get in touch with the it has to be a powerful message. It has to get in touch with the feelings that American workers have. People are angry. They don't like their wages are not going up very much, and they're paying higher taxes. Their bills are going up. Their real estate taxes, everything, gasoline, and we're not touching that. We're not organizing that. And the media is key to organizing. And right now in this big debate that's going on in the union movement between the AFL and Service Employees International Union, the Teamsters, they're talking about organizing, but they're not talking about how to communicate with workers and how to, you know, speak to workers. And this is something, that's why I've called for this meeting, Tom, because I think this needs to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, so you're talking about building a cultural infrastructure or a progressive infrastructure. I should, by the way, for our listeners, I should, what is it called, disclosure. I am a union member. I'm a member of of AFTRA. And so, you know, here we are. Now, are you suggesting that an individual organization such as ILCA do this, or that the AFL-CIO do it, or I mean, who's going to, you know, on the right wing, we've seen where Richard Mellon Scaife basically came in, you know, with money from him and the Bradley Foundation and Joe Coors, right. And they created the Heritage Foundation 30 years ago, and more or less, and boom, you know, you had this communications infrastructure. I mean, it wasn't exclusively the Heritage Foundation, but that was certainly the early, you know, the early shock troops, and they now have it. I mean, I've been down at Heritage. I've debated conservatives there on three occasions now. They have very sophisticated studios, broadcast studios. Laura Ingraham used to broadcast a radio program from there. I've used their broadcast studios, in fact. And they're building a TV studio now. The last time I was down there, about, I don't know, 8 or 9 months ago, they were building a TV studio. And, I mean, they've got a lot of money, a lot of power, a lot of influence. Their tentacles are everywhere. They make, you know, very heavy use of these, you know, right-wing ideologue college and high school students as interns. And they're getting a lot done, in some cases with a lot of money, and in some cases not with a lot of money. It's really surprising how much is being done by people who are just volunteering and hanging out. Are you suggesting that there be some independent agency like the Heritage Foundation, or that somebody who's already part of labor or the labor organizations pick up this slack or take up this crusade or whatever you want to call it?
Well, I think that the AFL should have done this. I've watched them for 10 years under this administration, and quite frankly, I have not been impressed with their public affairs department. They meet in Washington with the communications directors of a lot of international unions, and they could have begun this process of putting together a network of media and reached out to media and communities and all over the country, but they haven't done this. So quite frankly, I got tired of waiting, Tom, and I think the ILCA is in calling for this. I'm asking that unions and other organizations, other media groups, get together and start talking about how we can work together to form something like the Heritage Foundation for the left, that we can have money and work on our media, have our own independent media, our own newspapers, our own cable stations, our own stations, support station programs like yours, Tom, officially support programs like yours and the other programs that are in favor of a lot of the union issues. Mm-hmm. So I think but it's, right now it's disorganized.
Yeah. Now, but at the same time, you've got, I mean, this is a bit of a challenge here, because the Heritage Foundation is like this independent group, and here we have now on the left the Think Progress, the Center for American Progress has come forward, and they're sort of a media hub, and then there's the Media Matters for America, David Brock's group, and these two groups were, as I recall, initially funded in part, in some substantial part, by George Soros, and to his credit, and they're doing pretty good work. Are you talking about an affiliation with them, or?
Yeah, well, I think that that could be a possibility, but I mean, I think we have to get our labor's own media house in order, and get organized, and then decide. I can't make these decisions. I'm not in the position to make these decisions for the union movement, but I think that we need to begin discussing how we're going to work with the other progressive media organizations. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about it. It's not part of the conversation.
It seems like ILCA would be a logical group to do it through. I mean, why not propose that your own organization pick up this ball and run with it?
Well, to tell you the truth, Tom, there are resolutions at our convention, which we have coming up in Chicago from July 21st to 23rd, and we have resolutions coming up that address just that, mm-hmm. that we might want to do something like that. But, we're concerned that labor is not getting a strong message out to workers in this country.
Right.
I mean, quite frankly, even though the intent of a lot of the messages that are coming from our leaders in Washington is good and a lot of the subject matter is good, it doesn't resonate with working people who are struggling day in. They're not getting the message, and they're not relating to it. So we have to work on getting this done. That's my plan.
Yeah.
And I put it out there. I want to have discussions on it, and I hope to convene this meeting in the fall, probably in either New York or Washington, and try to move forward. Maybe it'll be also a unifying force in a labor movement that is now looks like there's going to be a schism.
Yeah, to what extent might this schism, I mean, we've been, without getting too inside baseball here, I'd like to keep this relevant to all of our listeners. those in labor and those outside of the labor movement. And unfortunately, since Ronald Reagan started aggressively declared war on the labor movement when when he came into office, a quarter of the American workforce was unionized, and now the private union workforce is down less than 10%. They've had some success in devastating labor, and Bush certainly is working on it. So,
yeah.
It's not all of our listeners are union members by any means. So, keeping it relevant to all of them. How can people get involved in this? What can people who are not part of the labor movement do to help, forward this vision that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, for one thing, Tom, I guess your listeners know that about 35% of union members voted for George Bush in the last election against their own interests,
right,
which is a really a sorry figure. I would say that workers, and I think most of your listeners are probably consider themselves workers, can get involved in this by, if they're in unions, by trying to write letters to the editor, to their union newspapers. Hopefully they'll get published, although a lot of union newspapers don't publish letters to the editor. They can go to union meetings and talk about this. People who aren't in unions can start talking about organizing, and trying to get their message from the bottom up. I mean,
right.
People can publish their own newsletters.
The AFL-CIO has an organization. They have a website for and a group that you can join if you're not a union member, but you work and you want to be in solidarity with union members, do they not?
Yeah, they do, and I think the intent of that is good, although I don't know if they're listening to the people that are joining. I think they pay $5 a piece or something like that. But I think all too often the messages are top down, coming from the leadership down, and we have to start listening to our the workers out there and start channeling their energy and their anger, because we're not using that, and the best organizing can be done by workers among themselves, not from the top down.
Yeah, the whole point of a union, the whole point of having a unionized workplace is to have democracy in the workplace. And so why not have democracy within the union movement as well?
Well, yeah, we've been fighting for that. I mean, democracy in the labor media, so that there would be dialogue, there would be controversial letters to the editor. I mean, there's not enough of it.
Yeah.
And we've been fighting for this for years now. And I think democracy is the key to what we're talking about.
Yeah. Well said. We've been talking with Marty Fishgold. Marty Fishgold is the president of the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA Online, their website. If you'd like more information, I encourage you to check it out. I'll be at their convention in July. July, what is it, 21st through the 23rd, Marty?
21st to the 23rd, yeah.
Right. I'll be there and look forward to seeing you and hopefully some of our listeners. Martin Fishgold, thank you so much for being with us, Marty.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
And keep up the great work there in Washington, D.C., the work that you guys are doing. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. You're in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. George Bush offered strong support for Vietnam's joining the World Trade Organization by the end of the year, according to the Wall Street Journal today. There's a piece to this story that I really want to highlight. I really want to share with you. But the church and state discussion that we started a little earlier on, I just kind of wrap that up. This is really not ultimately about who's religious and who's not and what religion there is and what religion there isn't. It's all about power. It's really all about power. What was it? Was it Mark Twain or Will Rogers who said if Jesus came back, he wouldn't be a Christian? A friend of mine, a mentor of mine, Herr Mueller, used to say the same thing. It's really and truly scary what has happened to the religion that I was raised in and how it's been hijacked in some parts. Now, I think, frankly, what's happening is that all across America, there are people who are saying, hey, wait a minute, this isn't the Christianity that I knew. This isn't what I, you know, this is a lunatic fringe. Just like all over the Muslim world, there are people saying Osama bin Laden doesn't represent me. Sorry. And in fact, I mean, that was the position of 99.9% of the Muslim world at the day after 9/11. Now, increasingly, you know, with our invading Iraq and all, you know, the nonsense the Bush administration has been doing, it's hurting us in that regard. But, you know, so we'll see where it goes. Mike in Michigan on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I wanted to get my 2 cents in about the church-state issue, if you don't
okay.
mind.
Okay, sure.
You know, I studied history in college, including a year of graduate school, and constitutional history was my favorite subject. And my feeling is that these conservative Republican politicians and these Christian heretics on the right are actually trying to subvert the Constitution and our form of government.
Yes. Now, there's no doubt about that. The question is, are they doing it intentionally or unintentionally? Because their language implies that they don't know what's in the Constitution.
Yes, but I think they know what they're doing.
I mean, the word God does not appear in the Constitution. Nowhere. The only founding document that has God in it is the Declaration of Independence, which is not a legal document. It's not our Constitution. We're not governed by the Declaration of Independence. And that doesn't refer to the Christian God. It refers to nature's God, which is a big debate between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. And
sure.
And so, you know, the only place where God does not appear, we have a godless constitution. We literally do. We were created as a secular nation. You know,
absolutely.
it's fine to have churches. They just don't run the country. It's, you know, that's the definition of a secular nation. And how these people can say that people want to take God out of the Constitution when God was never in the Constitution in the first place is beyond me.
Well, I think they know what they're saying, and they know they actually doing it with purpose and intent. Because it's, as you probably know, I'm sure you do, that even during the ratification process of the Constitution, the conservative Christian right opposed ratification because the Constitution forbids a religious test for public office.
Right.
And the Christians on the right.
Well, it was mostly the delegates from Massachusetts who opposed that. Massachusetts
That's
was the
true.
most conservative and the most religious. You know, that's where the Puritans first hung out. There were still Puritans, you know, around. I mean, they were hanging witches when Ben Franklin was a kid. It's one of the reasons why he left Massachusetts and went to Pennsylvania.
Well, so they were opposed to that because they wanted a religious test for office. And one of the quotes I heard was we could have a primitive Mohammedan running for a public office.
Yeah.
In the original.
Yeah, exactly. That
if
was,
didn't have a religious test.
That was their argument, right? And heaven yeah. forbid that would happen, right? And but the founders had seen enough of this up in Massachusetts, in particular, to know what was going on, and so they were not going to put a religious test into there, and they didn't wisely. In fact, they prohibited it.
You know that? Did you know? I heard this on the radio a couple of weeks ago that during the Civil War, a large group of ministers tried to get proposed amending the preamble to the Constitution to include a dedication to God and Jesus Christ in the preamble to the Constitution.
Yeah.
And of course, Lincoln and the Congress rejected it. They buried it and it didn't get passed.
Yeah, and you would expect Lincoln to reject that because, you know, he was the guy didn't go to church, but he considered himself a Christian as well. Go figure. Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. Good to hear from you. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Van Morrison there. Yeah, we'll make it through. We'll make it through. Democracy has extraordinary resilience. You know, the thing that I find most amazing about it is this research that was done by Conrad and Roper back about 3 years ago at the University of Sussex in England. Or was it the University of Essex? One or the other. In any case, it was published in Nature. And they said, you know, for years and years and years, people have assumed that animals are not democratic, but rather are hierarchical, that they're set up as kingdoms, that there is an alpha animal who makes all the decisions and all the choices and, you know, has all the, and everybody follows the alpha animal, and that's just all there is to it, period. And they said, well, let's test this. Nobody had tested it. I mean, even Darwin was assuming this. Let's test this hypothesis. Let's find out if this is the case. And, you know, let's find out. And so they checked out. There was a herd of red deer near there, near the university. And so they went down and they set up cameras and they observed these red deer for a while. And what they found was you got a bunch of deer and they're sitting around, you know, chewing the grass. And at some point, there's a couple of water holes nearby. And at some point, they've got to decide, when do we go drink and which water hole do we drink at? Now, these are not small decisions for a herd of deer, because if they don't go, if they go too early, then some of the deer among them may not get enough nutrients. They would be hungry. On the other hand, if they go too late, somebody might get dehydrated. If they pick the wrong water hole and they pick one that's poisoned, somebody might get sick. If they pick one that's too muddy to drink out of, you know, it doesn't, you know. So there's a lot of variables. This is not just a simple thing. And if there's a predator in the area, it becomes even more complex. So they're like, you know, what do we do? How do we figure this out? And the assumption has been, for thousands of years, the assumption has been, well, you know, the alpha male will simply decide, or with some species like wolves, the alpha female will simply decide, and everybody will follow. That was the assumption. And, you know, and Darwin seemed to reinforce that, and it's just, you know, it's been a long-held belief. And so Conrad and Roper said, well, let's check this out. So they're looking at the deer, and they're noticing that the deer are all pointing in random directions as they're just kind of standing around chewing their cuds. And when it comes up to the time that the herd of deer normally, more or less, go to drink, they notice that the animals start organizing themselves, not individuals, but, you know, or not in groups, but rather individuals, just start kind of turning and pointing toward one of the three watering holes. And when 51% of the deer are pointing at a particular water hole, when that one deer that makes it right over the 50% points at that water hole, boom, the whole crowd goes charging toward that water hole. And very often the alpha animal's in the back going, hey, where'd everybody go? Now, it turns out the alpha animal has first choice of sexual partner. And that makes sense in a Darwinian sense because, you know, the whole selfish gene notion of Richard Dawkins, the selfish gene, the idea that one of the reason why we use sex to reproduce is so that there can be a filtering mechanism. So the goose that can fly the longest distance or the peacock with the best feathers, you know, if that's a survival adaptation, or the strongest of the antelope or whatever, that they're going to pass on their genes. So the stronger members of the society are continually passing on their genes. So the alpha animal has a first choice of sexual mate. But in terms of running the show, no way. Now, there are some animals where the alpha animal may also be the lead hunter, for example, with wolves, but very often that means that the alpha animal dies more frequently. So it turns out that animals make decisions democratically. And when Conrad and Roper published this, I interviewed one of them. I interviewed Conrad, as I recall. I wrote about it in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? And when I interviewed this guy, he said, when we published our results in Nature, you know, about the red deer, then people started coming out of the woodwork. Other biologists saying, hey, you know, the same thing happens with my gorillas. The same thing happens with my coyotes. The same thing's happening with my prairie dogs. Same thing's going on with my rats. The same thing's going on with my hive of bees. The same thing's going on with my fruit flies. It's like, did you ever see a swarm of gnats? I remember when I was a little kid sitting down by the riverbank and a swarm of gnats just hanging out there like this round thing or kind of oval shaped thing suspended about 3 feet above the ground. And it's just like this kind of gray cloud of gnats. And it would just suddenly move off to the right or off to the left. How do they know to do that? You ever watch a bunch of birds flying? How do they know when to turn? They're not following the leader. If they were following the leader, they'd move like a semi-truck moves. You know, they'd all kind of swing around. That's not what happens. They all move at the same time. Or a school of fish. You ever watch fish? And boom, 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 left, right, left. And they're swimming around. They're all, and it's not follow the leader. Instead, what's going on is, with their very rapid peripheral vision, they're all measuring the movement of as many of their peers as they can see. And when a majority of their peers have decided to move in a particular direction, they move in that particular direction. And when that, as that echoes through the entire school or the entire swarm or the entire hive or the entire you know, troop or whatever, you know, pick your species, then everybody moves. And it's just happening so fast. In other words, they're voting thousands of times a second. It's happening so fast that to our slow eyes, it looks like they're all moving instantaneously. But they're not. They're all making little micro motions as, this is my vote, let's go this way. This is my vote, let's go this way. And when a majority is reached, boom, they go. Democracy is burned into our genes. This is what Thomas Jefferson was talking about when he had this argument with John Adams about how God should be referred to in the Declaration of Independence. And Adams said it should be the Christian God, Adams from Massachusetts, and Jefferson said, no, it should be nature's God. Democracy is part of the natural world, and everybody laughed at him for saying that. He said, you will find democracy throughout nature. And he was ridiculed for it. Right up until last year. Turns out Thomas Jefferson was right. And when in the Declaration of Independence, he referred to nature's God, he was right. This is part of our genetics. It's wired into us. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, people go, oh, you know, the United States, the democracy is doomed. Well, you know, over the short term, it may be. Certainly we've lost a lot of our democratic freedoms. Certainly this administration is hell-bent for leather on trampling the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. The right of speech, the First Amendment clearly says that the right to peaceably assemble and petition for redress of grievances shall not be abridged. And yet try to assemble and petition George Bush for redress of grievance, it ain't going to happen. He won't even let people into a speech that he's given if they've got a no blood for oil bumper sticker. So, you know, the First Amendment, they don't care about the First Amendment, these guys. The Fourth Amendment, your right of privacy. No, now they can do sneaking peeks. They can break into your house and not even tell you. So, you know, I will acknowledge we are losing our democratic freedoms to an autocratic regime. No doubt about that. But I believe that democracy is absolutely and incredibly resilient because it is burned into our genes. It is part of who we are, as not just as humans, but as members of the not just mammals, as members of the animal kingdom. There's that word again. Patriarchy, hierarchy, the kingdom. Yes. Well, nonetheless, as members of the animal kingdom, it's burned into our genes. It's in our DNA. And that's why I'm convinced that, if we just keep beating the drum, it'll come back. Tribal people have known this for hundreds of thousands of years. Many of them are still living democratically. They certainly were, most of them, when we arrived here in North America. We Europeans or Africans or, you know, arrived here in North America. Said, whoa, what's going on? It's one of the reasons why the framers of the Constitution borrowed so heavily from the Iroquois Nation. So, you know, this is, you know, whether those of us who came, you know, or whose ancestors came voluntarily or those of us whose ancestors came involuntarily, which, you know, includes not just African Americans, but also a lot of white Americans, Caucasian Americans came here involuntarily. Georgia, the state of Georgia, was a penal colony for England for a long time until finally we said no, no more. And then they started shipping them to Australia, for example. But nonetheless, you know, anybody who came here, however we got here, we looked around and we said, hey, you know, there's Native people who are living here with this funny thing. They don't call it democracy. They didn't use the Greek language. You know, demos is from the Greek for people. But it seems to work that way. Why is it that among indigenous people, democracy is everywhere? Because it works. Because they have 10,000 years of trial and error. Or 100,000 years of trial and error. And it works. It'll work here too. Don't worry. It'll come back. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Catherine in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I want to say I'm not really well versed in politics, but I'm learning so much from your show. I just love your show.
Well, thank you.
But I was just curious. You know, I mean, I'm thinking to myself, the Democrats were just getting totally screwed. Nobody hears our voice. How about if we infiltrate the TV stations?
How so?
On the phone. I mean, just all the Democrats get on the phone and bitch, just like coaches do with basketball. You know, like Larry Brown, go Pistons. He bitches about the coaches, and the coaches, after a while,
they listen. Right. Yeah, well, this was Lee Atwater's strategy during, and you know, he really pioneered this thing back during the Reagan administration of, if anybody in the media said anything that they considered negative toward Ronald Reagan or George Bush later on when Lee Atwater ran Bush Sr.'s campaign, then you would go after them, and it's called, and Lee Atwater called it working the refs, and yeah, and the Republicans and the conservatives have turned this into an art form, an absolute art form. Anybody in the media speaks out at all, they get hammered. And I agree that we on the left, the left that believes in clean air and a decent, you know, good forests and national parks and rational energy policy and good schools and social security and you know, adequate police forces and you know, good fire departments and gee, holy cow, the left who believes in decent pay, living wage. Yeah, those of us on the left, which I think, frankly, is most Americans.
Yeah.
We need to start, as you say, we need to start working the refs, too. And when you hear outrageous statements being you know, repeated in the media, you know, deal with specifics, not generality. You don't call up a TV station and say, hey, why are you so conservative? You call up and you say, hey, you know, when you quoted Dick Durbin the other day, you took his quote out of context. And you need to provide the actual quote that he said about what the FBI said about what the interrogation practices were like. Don't just report the fact that he said that, you know, that it sounded, if you heard this without knowing it was our people, you would have thought that it was the Nazis. And by the way, he attributed this to the FBI.
Okay.
And, so
how many people listen to your show?
I don't know.
Okay, you know, well, enough
couple,
people,
you know, a couple hundred thousand
enough,
anyway.
Enough
it's
people,
you know,
okay, enough people, 100,000 to call and bitch at stations.
Yeah, we need, you know, in fact, if you add up the rate cards of all our radio stations and things, I don't know, it's 300,000-400,000, a little less than 500,000, I'd guess.
Yeah.
Which is not inconsequential. So, so call your TV station, call your radio stations, call your media. Yeah, I've been advocating this for a long time. Good one, Catherine. Thank you very much.
Great.
Good to hear from you.
I appreciate it.
Tony in Washington, D.C., and that's not using numbers the way that some folks do on the right of saying, well, we're in a city with a million people, so there's a million listeners. No, that's actual listeners. Tony in Washington, D.C. Hey, Tony, what's up?
I'm sorry. Question, right to the point. Do you think that McCain and the senator and the congressman from, I think from North Carolina, I'm not sure, when he said that it's time to pull out, let Democratic hopefuls like maybe Edwards and I think Hillary off the hook as DLC type slash moderate set slash DLC type prospective presidential candidates by not have to double speak. You know how you double speak saying that we're not going to leave the theater of action right now, talking to people who they have to talk to need financial backing, if you don't understand what I'm talking about.
Sure.
You talk, in other words, talking about both sides of their mouth. They say we want to be the party to replace their current party, who is definitely trashing the United States Constitution, but yet talking to the companies who say, look, we still do business in that arena some form. Do you think
GE's making a fortune because of the invasion in Iraq, and so we don't want to really upset them too much, do we?
Right. So I'm saying, do you think that he let them off the hook? And also, do you think there has to be such a discrepancy, a determination about whoever gets the mantle for the Democratic Party, they have to say, we're going to leave, because even people on the right now or moderates are saying, we're tired of leaving our children on the floor, in the desert to die on the line. And I'll take your question off. I'll take your answer off the air, because I think that's what the people.
Tony, I'm still not sure I understand exactly what you're. Are you suggesting that by McCain and I think it was Lindsey Graham coming out and saying, "Hey, let's set a time to get out of here."
Right.
That they're making it easier for the so-called moderate Democrats. I would call them right-wing Democrats.
Right.
Hillary Clinton and whatnot. And we'll see where she ends up, actually. I shouldn't characterize her totally right now, but, you know, she's moving around, I guess. It makes it easier for them to take ambiguous positions about the war and still succeed?
Right. Talk, you know, in other words, you appease both sides. They need you need corporate backing in order to run a successful campaign. There's no doubt about that. But also, he knows that the people are getting fed up. So you need to be, you can't go there and talk to people like myself and say, well, we need another 2 to 3 to 4 years to stay in there, knowing that people like Native are going to come up and say, no, we need a decisive action. Either you're with us or against us, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tony. Good to hear from you. I, you know, frankly, I don't know the answer to your question. It's a good question. To what extent are the actions of the Democrats empowering, you know, are the actions of the renegade Republicans, the anti-war Republicans, as it were, or the, you know, let's do something about this Republicans, empowering the so-called centrists, the right-wing Democrats? I don't know. It may be pushing the Dennis Kucinich Democrats further out into the field. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Let's just keep an eye on it, and we'll see. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been meek and hard like an oak. I've seen pretty people disappear like smoke. Friends will arrive, friends will disappear.
And welcome back, my friends.
If you want me, honey, baby, I'll be here.
Welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. President Bush offered strong support for Vietnam's accession to the World Trade Organization by year's end, writes the Wall Street Journal today. The Murray Hebert authored this piece on page A9 of today's Wall Street Journal. A little strange here. First of all, Bush wants to go to Vietnam. Now, he spent the better part of 3 or 4 years back in the 60s trying to get out of going to Vietnam. So now he's suddenly decided he's found that he wants to go to Vietnam. Why? Well, because there's cheap labor there. There's money to be made there. There may even be oil there. Yes, they have found some oil offshore in Vietnam. And which may end up being a source of conflict between Vietnam and China. Time will tell. But in any case, so George says he's going to go to Vietnam. Vietnam, the nation that we had to go to war with because they were communist. They're still communist. So are the communist Chinese. Well, when Bush came into office, we were doing $1.5 billion a year worth of business with Vietnam. It's not a lot. It's still a lot more than we were selling to them. So we had a trade deficit with Vietnam, but it was, it's a $1.5 billion in total business. No big deal. It has risen about 400-500%. Last year it was $6.4 billion. Now it's starting to get. Now we're starting to talk real money. We're starting to talk, you know, industries in America, companies in America making enough money off their relationship with Vietnam that they can lean on Bush. But here's the really interesting thing. The U.S. officials said more work is needed on lowering Vietnam's tariffs on imports. In other words, while we're dropping our import tariffs, while we're saying, okay, you can bring cheap Vietnamese labor into the United States in the form of finished goods, no problem. The Vietnamese are saying, but you can't bring cheap goods into Vietnam. You want to make something in some country that's got worse labor standards than us, you can't bring it into Vietnam. If you want to compete with Vietnamese industries, you can't do that. Sorry, we have import tariffs here. We're going to protect our domestic economy. They further said that Vietnam has to cut its non-tariff borders and open its telecommunications and financial services sectors. They're protecting their banks. They're protecting their telephone companies. They're protecting their radio stations. They're protecting their TV stations. We're saying, no, you can't do that. You got to let multinational corporations in there and run the show. Vietnam is saying, no, we're not going to do that. Sorry. But by the way, you want some cheap labor? And we're saying, oh, sure, okay, we'll take some cheap labor. Georgie will be over shortly. Does it get any weirder than this? And this from Republicans? I'm baffled. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.